that we don't need any more successful people in this world. We need people who are dreamers, who are storytellers, who are kind. I think you've got to at times see the funny side of things. And so I've rocked up to somewhere with an outfit that I've made, and it's, and I really quite like odd things, like an odd sleeve. I think I'd buy it off the rack if somebody made a dress like that, providing I could afford it. And so I rocked up somewhere with a dress with an odd sleeve. I didn't have enough material, but I thought it looked quite good. And I'd actually put a few buttons on this odd sleeve to sort of replicate the buttons on the front, you know, so that I made it marry. And and someone said, oh, did you run out of material? And, you know, they were being probably trying to hurt me, but what does my sense of humour do but say, no, I'm an influencer. For the 10 to 15 year olds, what will I do? And now this is where I have to say it's a gift. It's nothing to do with being clever. I went to bed and it must have been very close to Christmas Eve. And in the middle of the night, I thought of a rap song for them. Thought we could get, it was. And it picked all the eyes out of what was important. So it said, if you're a kid in care, knowing your rights is fine. The Charter of Rights was written in 99. It was written so that kids could be cool and understand your rights are protected in Queensland. You have a right to be happy and to have a say on your daily needs when you're cruising to stay. And if you want to find out what's happening for you, you have a right to straight answers, not a no can do.
Welcome to Songwriter Trysts. I'm singer-songwriter Ray Lee, and this is an intimate podcast talking to songwriters about their work, life, and lessons. Songwriting is a powerful art form that builds culture, connects communities, and addresses social issues in an impactful way. And here, we get to meet the artists who are doing just that. Today is a special episode with not just a songwriter, but also an author, Tess Rowley, a modern-day Mother Teresa with her creative writing works in children's books, novels, and songwriting. But the incredible work for non-for-profits that she's done has actually gone recognised this year with an Order of Australia, OAM. I'm so glad that Tess has come to talk to us today. If you have been listening to this podcast for a while, you may have noticed that child protection advocacy is a major reason behind my work as an artist and this podcast, and that there is much more needed to change in the space for child welfare, rights and protection. Tess Rowley and I discuss this in depth here. One of her books was even banned by the ABC in Australia when it first came out, and she talks about the reasons why the book was so controversial. Stay tuned as we dive into this very special episode with Tess Rowley. Tess Rowley. Okay, so this is a very special podcast. Now, this is Songwriter Trysts, where I talk to songwriters about their creative writing and their process in their life and how they got to where they are. And you are a songwriter, but you're a creative writer. You do all sorts of things, children's books, you've done a novel, and you've written some songs.
Yes.
And is it all or mostly for non-for-profit?
Mostly. I've probably written 30 children's books, and Everyone's Got a Bottom is the first book that I've started selling purely because they gave it back to me. I think that their business is changing, and so they didn't want to sell it anymore. And I'd kept saying, "Why aren't you selling it overseas?" I keep getting calls from overseas.
Right.
Yeah. So it's the first book that you could say, if I ever do make a profit from it, because at this stage, I'm not so sure.
I mean, as an artist, to try and make a profit, so we're all non-for-profits, even if we're not registered as one, because we're creating art, and you don't create it for the profit, you create it for the community and what you're giving back.
And my Nazareth House book, at the end of the year, from selling it from Christmas to Christmas, I made $2,000 profit.
Wow.
But considering that I've been writing it for 20 years.
It doesn't compensate you for your time, does it?
No.
And art very rarely does.
Yes.
So the way I like to start this podcast is tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from.
So thank you for asking me that. I'm Tess Rowley, and I'm a mother and a grandmother. And I actually was originally from York in England, which was where I grew up.
Yep.
But then at 19, I left England, very full of adventure, a pack on my back, and set off for New Zealand. But let's begin at the beginning, because when I was born, I was born in London, because my father was in the army, but at the age of two, we moved back to York, because he was a York man. And my mother was a nurse.
And, oh, me too.
And then when I was 4 years old, my father had been treated for indigestion, but unfortunately there were ulcers that burst and he was rushed to hospital. That's one of my early memories of aged four, Dad screaming at night and my sister and I wondering what was happening. We thought, we lived in one of those Coronation Street style houses joined together, so we thought it was the man next door who sometimes came home drunk. But then we realised we could hear somebody crying and we ran downstairs and it was Mum crying and Dad was clawing the wallpaper off the walls. And as a result, it was pioneering surgery in York, and they removed over half of his stomach.
Oh, wow.
But because he was under the anaesthetic for so long, he was brain damaged.
Oh.
So he was in hospital for 1 year, and Mum has only explained to me in recent years that had he died, she would have got a pension. But because he was in hospital for 1 year, she got nothing. And so how on earth she raised us, I do not know. But I do remember being hungry. And when Dad came out of hospital 1 year later, she was told that because of his brain damage, she could put him into an institution if she wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But I can imagine, Mum, she said, I can imagine her how she would have looked, smart and indignant.
Yeah.
I'm a state registered nurse and he will come home with me.
Yep. Sounds like my mum.
So, it's a good woman. So she brought him home. And obviously it was a real love match, because in spite of the fact that he was unemployed for the next year, he couldn't find a job.
Yeah.
Mum fell pregnant again.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I was 5 years old at that stage.
It was functioning in one way.
And my sister was seven. So the love was still there.
Yeah.
And my brother was born, Philip. He was born prematurely and with one arm. That was a bit of a sad blow to Mum and Dad, because there were obviously nervousness about the future for him. Mm-hmm. However, he's excelled in everything, as often happens with premature babies. He's a strong man. Mum and Dad, I would say, had a very, very loving, happy life, except that when Dad finally got work, it was just a labourer. And so the money was never big, and it was hard for Mum to go back to work in those days. There was no childcare centres and things.
Yeah.
And so I remember being hungry for a lot of the time in those early years. There was not enough money to go around. It's helped me in adult life, because I'm able to help other disadvantaged people make a meal out of nothing, because I saw Mum do it. And and I can remember the whole feeling of what happens when you don't have any money. There's a school excursion and you don't even look up from your desk. You just keep writing, because I know we can't afford it.
Yeah.
And also not having the full school uniform, and hoping the teacher doesn't notice that you've not got the full school uniform, which you were supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's given me so much more compassion for children who don't just always come up to the mark according to school's rules. And so I would say that for all somebody might say, oh, that was a disadvantaged childhood, it also has advantages, because it's given me a deeper appreciation. And of course, the funny thing is that as a child, I had no idea that my dad was brain damaged. He was the only man I knew. I've never had an adult conversation with my father.
Mm-hmm.
He hardly spoke to us. And I just thought that's how men behaved.
You don't know any different, do you?
No.
Yeah.
Which didn't augur well when I was choosing a partner for myself, because I wasn't quite sure what I was looking for in a man.
Mm.
So I forgive myself for my first choice of partner.
Don't we all?
But however, Dad did die in his 60s, and Mum he never made it to Australia, which is a shame.
Yes.
But Mum has been out several times. And at one stage, we were talking about some of the funny things Dad did.
Yes.
And you don't need to hear all this, but it's we call this one the day Dad blew the toilet up. and all the windows got blown out in the bathroom and toilet. Experimenting in the toilet bowl with cleaning agents that you're not supposed to mix. And eventually exploded. So we were having a laugh yet again about the day Dad blew the toilet up. And Mum said, oh, poor old George, that was his brain damage. And I said, and I would have been in my 40s, what do you mean brain damage? And Mum said, oh, you must know. And no, I had no idea. But he was in hospital for a year. I remember that, but I didn't know it was brain damaged.
Yeah.
And so Mum, there she is telling me all those years later, which suddenly I had a deeper understanding of Dad.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, the day I got married, age 19, my dad didn't want to wear a shirt and a tie because he said he'd get pneumonia. And Mum was sort of saying, George, you have to. You're walking your daughter down the aisle.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just wanted to wear his tartan flannelette shirt that was warm. And,
yeah.
And you know, for all, I just accepted that was Dad. But I still could see my mum's point of view. You know, you do need a shirt and tie, Dad. But once again, I accepted it. And isn't it amazing how we are? We're so accommodating.
We're adaptive.
With people we love.
Especially when we're young. As children, I have a very similar disadvantaged childhood, which we've talked about off the podcast.
Yes.
But I also think there are different personalities. I don't really know what it is, but some people like yourself come out of that situation and thrive because you make choices that you're not going to accept the way things were. Whereas other people in a different personality might go, well, this is the way it is and it's never going to change. And they'll have two completely separate lives. I mean, have you ever thought about that? Have you met other people that have a similar history to you and have a different outcome? What would you put that down to?
Yes, well, I think it is just your personality type because I've often thought when I see, because I have done some work in the prisons and I look at a lot of people who have had disadvantaged childhoods who've ended up in prison because they've broken the law. And I've thought, isn't it a shame that so many of them, they've just got that oddness about them that doesn't make them quite so socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. So they don't quite fit in at school. Whereas I think for me, I've always been able to just be a bit more of a chameleon and fit in where I need to be accepted. Not that I was ever accepted by the higher echelons of society, but I've always managed to sit somewhere, and also I've got a creative side which has allowed me to make clothes out of nothing.
Yeah,
and when you're young,
you can get away with
murder, can't you? You know, with making clothes out of nothing.
I remember making clothes in high school early, like 12, 13 for high school, because I wasn't able to have new clothes, I only had hand-me-downs.
Yes,
so I learned how to sew and make it so that it looked like it was the fashion in fashion.
Yes.
And if someone made a mistake and said, was that brand or something, I'd say, yeah. But you adapt, especially,
yes.
I think you're right. I think it is the creative brain.
That's right,
that
yes.
That allows us to be adaptive, but also the pressure and pain of wanting to change certain things. So, like, put a creative person in a difficult situation, you find a solution, won't you?
Yes, yes. And also I think having a sense of humour, you know, some people just don't have – I think you've got to at times see the funny side of things.
Mm.
And so I've rocked up somewhere with an outfit that I've made, and I really quite like odd things, like an odd sleeve. I think I'd buy it off the rack if somebody made a dress like that, providing I could afford it. And so I rocked up somewhere with a dress with an odd sleeve. I didn't have enough material, but I thought it looked quite good.
Yeah.
And I'd actually put a few buttons on this odd sleeve to sort of replicate the buttons on the front, so that I made it marry. And and someone said, oh, did you run out of material? And, they were being probably trying to hurt me. But what does my sense of humour do but say, no, I'm an influencer.
Because that's what you do, you adapt.
That's right.
I love that.
And you stick up for yourself because, I could see that she didn't like what I was wearing, but I liked it. And so that's what I said. So I think if you've got that ability, you're not so likely to need to steal a car and then have the cops chasing you and end up in prison.
Yeah.
Because I'm a survivor, and I've got a sense of humour, and I've been blessed with a gift of writing, which it is a gift. Sometimes people say, oh, aren't you clever? No, I'm not. I was just an ordinary student at school, hopeless at maths. And
but you were naturally talented.
Actually thought I was stupid, when I was at school. So I left school at 15 and could get out and get a job. I mean, we were working class anyway. We could not have afforded me to go on after 15.
Yeah.
So all of us left school at 15 in my family. But, it took me a while to realise, probably in my 20s, that I'm actually not stupid. stupid. And when I started meeting people who'd gone to university, I thought, you know what? I think I'm as smart as she is. And so then in my late 20s, I went back here in Brisbane. That was by which time I had two children. And I decided that I'd like to do some study. I actually, at 15, got a hairdressing apprenticeship.
Okay.
So I was a hairdresser, but it didn't really fit in with children anyway. No outside school I was caring those days. And so I went to night school and did year 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. And the first subject I did was English because I knew I was good at that.
Yeah.
There's no way I'd sign up for maths.
Oh, see, I really struggled with English because I was dyslexic and my spelling was terrible.
Yeah.
But I pushed myself. I did literature and regular English because I knew that I had to do that to get to where I wanted to be.
Yes.
But now as a writer, I do laugh. I mean, I've gotten better because I just, you know, you work hard at it. But I do laugh sometimes thinking no English teacher I ever had would have ever thought I'd be a writer or do anything that had anything to do with spelling or English.
Yes, yes. And of course, the amazing thing about that is because I've got a lot of friends who can't spell and even my partner, he can't spell and yet he's highly intelligent. Mm. And in fact, it's quite funny if he asks me how to spell something and I'll spell it out, he says, oh, is it still spelt like that?
Yeah, it should change over time, right? Evolve.
Because there is an embarrassment and there shouldn't be. It's just the way your brain's wired.
Yeah.
And my brain was always wired to almost be able to pick a spelling mistake in the middle of a newspaper.
Yeah.
Because it just looks odd, and it's just a gift that
there
I was given. But when I was used to go to Sunday school through my childhood, we were strong Methodists, my family, and we really liked the jumble cells too. And a Sunday school teacher, when she heard that I'd left school and I was a hairdresser, she saw me in the street and she said, "Oh, I always hoped you'd use your gift of English," and that was the first time anyone told me that I had a gift. I didn't know I was any good at English.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was any different from any other kid in the class. But I've likened that to a pearl that she dropped in my ear. And from time to time, I've been able to pull it out and just examine it again and see that, I have got a gift. So when I did English my very first year at high school, aged 28, and I got a good mark at the end, I said to my husband at the time, I wish I could let Miss Mattison know.
Oh.
So that was my Sunday school teacher. So if I can say anything in this invitation to speak, it would be, remember when you're speaking to children, you're dropping pearls into their ears.
Absolutely.
And you just never know how you'll influence and encourage someone by saying something positive about what they're good at.
And they're so malleable. And like I have the same. And I think everyone has that one or two or three teachers that said something encouraging that we latch onto and we identify with. But will we ever be able to tell them retrospectively how much of an impact that made? Probably not. And teachers maybe don't get, like, just don't know how much of an impact they're actually having because they won't see it. It'll happen in 10, 20, 30 years.
Yes. And occasionally I do get asked to speak to schools, especially when I was working in child protection. And and I have often said, you've got no idea how powerful you are.
Mm.
And the words that you say to children in the class have got meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure that it's positive. Because when they're my age, and there I am standing as a grandma in front of them, you've got no idea how a childhood really does last a lifetime. And you still remember the hurts that were said and the positives that were said. And this is your harvest, the harvest of the seeds that you've sown as a teacher, the future of that child.
And the pearls, like you said, are really important. But you're right, I think there's poison that can get put in as well.
Oh, yes.
I've got three kids, they're all in primary school, and one of them is ADHD. He's very creative, but he's had a lot of poison from teachers over the years that it's almost damaged that we're now trying to deal with. But it's heartbreaking as a parent to see that, you know, creative people, we're ostracized by most of society because our brains are so different.
Yes.
Now we're needed, but we're a minority. And it's so challenging to see my child go through the same ostracism or whatever you call it that I went through and you probably experienced as well
you
think differently. It's a challenge.
Yes. In fact, there was a lovely saying by David Orr that we don't need any more successful people in this world. We need people who are dreamers, who are storytellers, who are kind.
That's us.
And it really spoke to me because I thought, it's right. You know, we've got to become kinder.
We do. Yeah. Too many successful people out there with too much money and
Yes.
Maybe not enough kindness. But I don't know much about that. So you finished your high school education.
Yes.
And how did you get into this, like doing books? Like where did that start?
Well, when I got into university, I must have to tell you, it wasn't just a straight run. I was a dropout several times. So I was I wasn't a teenage dropout.
That's all right.
I was a 30-year-old dropout. So I did a year of journalism and dropped out because it was so hard because I didn't have a car, get to university and I didn't have much money. So I used to work at Coles supermarket on a Thursday night and a Saturday because I had no one to mind the kids. So I did the supermarket checkout chick thing to earn some money to buy any books. And
which a lot of mums do today.
Yeah, that's right. And so I did a year and gave up. And my journalism, I think part of the disappointment was that I didn't particularly enjoy journalism, even though it seemed to be the avenue for me with the gift I'd been given. But once again, one of the words that got dropped in my during one lecture was never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Oh, yeah.
And the lecturer said that, and I thought, you know, I'm better than that. I don't want to be a person like that who never lets the truth get in the way of a good story. And we had to do interviews, mock interviews with people. And at the end of the year, I was quite disillusioned because I thought, do I really want to be a journalist? And so when I did finally go back to university a couple of years later, the journalism teacher saw me on the campus and he called out and he said, what happened to you? And so he said, you're not, well, he welcomed me back. He realised I dropped out. And I said, all that stuff you were teaching me, it was wrecking my writing.
Oh, ouch.
And that's what I didn't realise how hurtful that would be to him, but he didn't quite say ouch. He just said, you cheeky thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, but anyway, I got into social work, started to realise that I really did want to make a difference and perhaps that was the avenue for me. And so my first job was in child protection as a senior, not a senior, but a mature social worker working with families who, for one reason or another, had come to the attention of the department. And I have to tell you here that working with people who are disadvantaged for whatever reason, hairdressing was the best skill in the world, because before long, the very first or probably the second client I ever had was a young woman. She was 19. She'd already had two children removed for gross abuse and neglect, and now she had a third child who the neighbours were already complaining about her treatment of this third child. And so part of the role that I had to play as very much a junior person in the child protection unit was to, I was called a family support worker because I hadn't quite graduated. I won't go into that, but as to what happened next. But anyway, as a support worker, family support worker, my role with her was to get her to get this child to a playgroup so that the child could be socialised and mum could also have links in the community that might be supportive. And so the first time you go out with a senior social worker, and she remarked on the way back to the office, "Oh, aren't you good with people?" And I said, "Yeah, I used to be a hairdresser. I can talk to anybody." So she was quite surprised how at ease I was with this young lady. And then the second time I went by myself to the house, the young lady opened the door and she'd just washed her hair and she'd got a big towel swathed around her head and she said, "Oh, I forgot you were coming and I've got a headache and can you come back another day?" Now, that I wasn't really allowed to do that. I had to see the child because that was part of my responsibility to make a check that the child was okay. And the child was incredibly neglected, like sores on their bottom because the nappy hadn't been changed and stuff like that. But anyway, what I said to her was, "Look, let me comb your hair because we can talk while I'm combing your hair because I do need to see you and I need to see the little one." And she said, "Oh no, I've got a headache." And I said, "Look, I used to be a hairdresser. I could even probably get rid of that headache. I'll be so gentle." Yeah. So I went inside and I would have combed her hair for at least 3/4 of an hour.
Oh, wow.
Just gently stroking her hair. And while I was gently stroking her hair, we talked about parenting. We talked about our expectations of what we want from life. Of course, two women together, we talked about sex because she'd already had two other children, one when she was 15. And I suspected that she'd probably never really been told anything about satisfying sex or looking after your body. And so I was able to share woman to woman, you know, what she, her expectations should be of the men in her life in the future, so that she could feel loved and protected and cared for. We talked about everything, which the beauty of hairdressing is, of course, you're not looking face to face. So you can talk about things that might be embarrassing without being embarrassed. And so we had the most lovely session. And of course, the next time I went to her house, she greets me at the door with a picture of a Hollywood starlet, the hairbrush in her hand, and said, "Will you do this style for me before we go to playgroup?"
Oh, wow.
So in the shake of an eye, I had her looking like Cleopatra. And off we went to playgroup. And I did her hair every time. And I'm quite sure that the department would have been horrified.
Oh, really?
Because it wasn't quite what they would have seen my role being. However, it got her to playgroup. She was the most popular woman there because everybody said, "Oh, I love your hair." And of course, I was there just jeans and a t-shirt. Nobody quite knew where I was from, and so I was just her friend who did her hair. And you know, that was one of my, where I did get a harvest, because so often you work with a family and you never get to know what happens next. But I actually bumped into her years later, and it turns out that that little baby girl had finished school at 15. Year 12.
Wow.
She'd got a job at Coles working at a supermarket, and that's where she was going to work when she left school. So just to think that this was a family where the child had actually stayed at school right to year 12.
Yeah.
I was so proud, and of course, sure was she when she told me the story. And she had a couple of more children, and and she'd made a success of her life. You know, she
turned it around.
And yeah,
little
she
things
had.
Like that. And you don't always get to, like we talked earlier, you don't always get to see the impacts, but it's nice when you do. It's encouraging.
Yeah. And
it's
she had a cleaning job. And so she was, you know, very proud of that too, that she'd sort of put food on the table. And she hadn't had a successful relationship, so that's a shame. But I mean, that's life. And occasionally we do get a harvest, and that was that was one where I have to bless hairdressing.
So how did you go from doing social work into what you're doing now? I mean, it's obviously been such a long time.
That's right. I've always been a writer. So even before I got to university, I was always writing poetry, and I used to say my poetry to different women's groups because unfortunately my husband wasn't keen on me having hobbies and things. He was very much the old-fashioned husband who thought my place was you know, either earning a dollar or looking after the children. And so I couldn't join a theatre group or the things that I would have loved to have done. But if I wrote poetry, you don't need quite as much time as writing a book, and you can actually perform it somewhere, because I write a lot of funny poetry about all sorts of funny things. And so I could be quite entertaining, and I would get asked to go and say my poetry at different women's groups, which I could sort of do and scuttle home without my husband even knowing I'd been out.
Cheeky. I like it.
Yeah, so I was able to develop my writing skill. And by the time that I started work in child protection, they needed children's books that were Australian rather than American or English, because A, the overseas books were expensive, and B, they often didn't have the right language, you know, sort of Marmy and Sidewalk. They were looking for a writer. And of course, I just walked straight into that job. I'd been 5 years working in child protection. And then I actually had a year off because my husband did an overseas year in England, during which time I wrote a one-woman play and performed it at the Edinburgh Festival, which was highly successful. But then, of course, I came back and had to find another job. And I went back to the department, and there was this centre opening called the Queensland Centre for Prevention of Child Abuse. And so I became a resource officer there, and one of the jobs was to write children's books. So within weeks, I illustrated them myself too. And I will share the story that I illustrated them because I wanted to give the idea of this is what I envisage with my words. But when it went to the printer, he said, "Could the artist use the correct medium?" I'd used a biro. So I rang him up and said, oh, no, we're going to get it illustrated. They're my drawings. But I said, we're going to get it illustrated. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, he said, they're beautiful because it looks like a child's drawn them.
Yeah.
So this is the first three children's books with my illustrations went to print. So within weeks, the QCPCA, Queensland Centre for Prevention of Child Abuse, had books to take to a conference in Melbourne. I didn't go because I was just a junior, but the senior ones went. And they were able to display them for our new initiative in Queensland of looking at how do we prevent child abuse rather than waiting for it to happen.
Yep.
What supports do families need? Because I had a strong belief for the 5 years that I was working in child protection that there but for the grace of God go I. I was always amazed when I spoke to the, it was mostly women, very rarely did I work with a dad, about where things had gone wrong with the way they were raising their children. Because I firmly believe no woman goes through all that labour of pushing a baby out to be born to plant a hermit. So so I've got this strong belief that we all want to do our best. And so it was a question of how can I help you do your best?
Yeah.
And we'd start off by talking, and quite often I'd say, tell me about your childhood. And always, without exception, it was horrific.
Mm.
And then I would be able to say to them the words along the lines of, if I'd had your childhood, I don't think I could be doing anything like as good a job as you're doing right now. So how do we get the show back on the road? Come on, let's work together, because I believe we sow the seeds and we reap the harvest. And I know that you deserve to reap a really happy harvest with your children.
And we need support as human beings in general. We're not meant to do everything on our own.
No.
And there's always going to be a time in our life when we need the support of our community, and having a child, I know, is that one time.
Yeah.
That was probably the first time in my life where I felt like, because I wasn't nurtured as a kid, and you get raised that you do everything yourself and you're independent, and I couldn't rely on other people until I had children, and I had three within 4 years, very close together, and I had postnatal depression, and I was dealing with the complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Oh my goodness, I don't think I'd be alive now if it wasn't for the women's groups that I went to, and the counselors and the therapy and all the women, the nurses that would come to my home. And like, that was the first time in my life where I'd had support, and oh my God, I needed it.
Yes.
But we all need it at some point, and there's no shame in it.
No. And there's no shame in saying I'm not a perfect parent. Mm-hmm. I get it wrong sometimes. And some days I would go to a client and they were having a better day than I'd just had, because my children were teenagers. So I just dropped my teenager off, who, as she got out of the car, said, I hate you. This place is like a prison. This is basically because I told her she couldn't stay out and go to a nightclub because she's only 15.
Yeah.
And so I was the worst parent in the world. And I would go to a client's home who was having a day where her little child was saying, I love you, mummy.
And, and you miss that, don't you? It's a phase they grow out of, unfortunately. I'm not looking forward to having teenagers.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're not perfect parents. We don't have perfect children either. No. Our children aren't perfect. And I think as women, we do need to join together and offer support. And rather than pointing the finger, offer the whole hand and say, what can I do? You know, that sounds like you're at your wit's end. And
how did you come up with these philosophies, though? I mean, your mum was obviously a superwoman, given everything that she went through.
Yeah.
But where did that come from for you, do you think? Was it just from your mother, or how did you come up with this? Women need that support. And
I think probably because, you know, the weakness in my childhood was poverty and hunger, knowing what it feels like to be hungry. And as a result, my health was never that good. I used to get really bad asthma, and if I got a cold, I could never shake it. I realised, looking back, my diet was quite inadequate. So I wasn't robust. And I think when you're not well, it sort of brings you down a bit to what's important in life.
Yep.
And then when I was newly married, my health once again wasn't good. I spent a long time at different times in hospital, and at one stage when the doctor in those days used to visit you in your home, I used to be so embarrassed as probably a 20-year-old married woman, but that I still hadn't dusted the dressing table, and he's going to be looking around thinking this is a bit of a grotty house, and dishes still in the sink because I was so ill.
Yeah.
And then on this occasion, sirens ringing, getting me to hospital because I just wasn't breathing. And and I remember when I woke up with drips in my arm and thinking, you know, I've spent the last 2 or 3 weeks worrying about dust on a dressing table. Isn't that ridiculous?
Yep.
When, you know, I could have died. And I lay there and I thought, what's really important? And I thought, what's really important is eating good food. Mm-hmm. So however ill you are, you've got to eat good food. And it doesn't have to be cooked. If you haven't got the energy to cook it, yep. you know, think, what can you do that's easy, mm-hmm. but nutrition-based. And you need clean clothes to wear, but mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how many is in the laundry waiting to be washed, providing you've got clean pants and
clean underwear, yeah.
And basically everything else falls into place after that, you know, and be kind to each other.
I think that's such good advice. And it's wisdom that it does, it just kind of comes eventually if you're compassionate towards yourself. But I remember having three kids and living in the house we're sitting in right now, and we built this house, and for some reason I had this expectation. I think my grandmother used to always be like, you have to be ready if the queen rocks up and knocks on your door unexpected. You know, you have to be ready for that, which is such a weird thing that is a very old school way of thinking. But I used to think, like, the house used to look like a display home, especially in the living and the kitchen area. And one day, because I was killing myself the same way, I was killing myself worrying about the dust and the clutter and the craft, because I love doing craft with my kids. And I go, what am I doing? I'm trying to make this house look like a house that doesn't have children. I have three children. If people come to visit, they should expect to see stuff that has three children living in it.
Yeah, yeah.
and you know, you can see I've got craft stuff everywhere now. But I remember at the time, I was the same. I was killing myself mentally though. No one else cared. I cared. It was such a me problem. And it's hard to get over that sometimes. You don't think about it, but it's like no one else cares. Everyone else expects – if you've got kids living in your house, you'll have toys and craft and things like that. And it doesn't have to look like a display home all the time.
That's right.
It's hard though.
Yes. I wrote a poem once about somebody visiting who I wasn't expecting.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the verses, you know, I should just say the first couple of verses, but it was one of those mornings when I didn't get dressed. I was still in my nighty and my hair was a mess. There was bags around my eyes and my nighty was, and there was bags around my eyes and my nighty, and I felt old and worn. My nighty was faded and the hem had been torn. I was slopping around, doing this, doing that, when at the front door came a rat-a-tat-tat. It was one of those mornings I look on with shame, and that was the morning that Tony came. It was lovely to see him. I said, step inside, while the brain in my head wished that I could have died. Oh, why didn't I wash all those dishes last night? The place looked a tip and I looked a fright. I said, please sit down, as I grabbed at a chair, moved yesterday's papers, brushed off the dog's hair. He doesn't call often. He lives far away. So why did he have to visit today? And on it goes, you know, of what happened. Yes.
But I think everyone can relate to that.
Yeah, yes.
And my parents, I mean, we had clutter everywhere when I was a kid, but we also had unexpected visitors every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember as a kid, I was horrified and ashamed. Yes. And even if I had a friend come over, I would kill myself trying to tidy this house that had seven other people living in it, sometimes more.
Yes.
And it's silly. We care so much about what other people think of us, and yet they're probably not even thinking what we think they're thinking of us, you know.
No, in fact, I mean, the poem goes on. I won't go on because it's going to take too much time, but it goes on to me writing the poem and then sending it to Tony. And then he sent me a funny letter back, which I made into another poem.
Yeah.
And he finished it off with, he was telling me all the reasons. Because the thing is, I tidied all the house up because he said he'd come back the next day when my husband was home. And so I got up early and, you know, that's the first poem. I got up early and set the alarm. Well, I thought a spring clean here won't do any harm.
Yeah.
And all the things I did, and then he didn't come. At the very end, he said, you know, so Tony, I write because you thought I was slack, but we looked like a palace and you never came back. And so then he wrote me a letter with all the reasons why he hadn't got back. But then the very last few lines is that, you know, he says that the best time that I had was not with dear old dad, but with Tessie in a nighty doing dishes.
I love that. Yeah, that's so classic.
Yeah, so it's two poems that tell a story about cluttered houses. And
so one of the things that you told me when I told you about the songwriting podcast is that you'd written the poetry which turned into a rap song for kids and was sung in Parliament.
Yes.
Is that right?
It's true.
So tell me about that story. How did that come about and what did you do to
Well, I'd become known then as the writer of the team in QCPCA. And so in 1999, there was a new charter because the 40 inquiry revealed a lot of children in institutions who'd been abused but had never had a voice. Mm-hmm. And it's the same now in foster care. You know, there's the odd things go wrong because the child hasn't been heard or felt that they had a voice to criticise what's going on. Mm-hmm. in foster care or... but certainly institutions in those days. Yeah. And so a charter was developed that for that not to happen again, where children would be given a voice. And of course, the legal document was like 3 inches thick. And it was put on my desk just before Christmas break and said, could you turn the Charter of Rights into something that children could read? It was sort of succinct enough. And the age range they gave me was 5 to 15. Wow. And so I went home very close to Christmas with this huge big legal document. And what I did was just pick the eyes out of, from especially from my history of working in child protection, of what are the important issues. Mm. And then I wrote a little rhyming story for the 5 to 10-year-olds, say. And that was like a little nursery rhyme thing that was put in a book with illustrations, and it started off with the nursery, with the thing about Cinderella and how she wasn't allowed to go to the ball. She wasn't allowed any playtime at all, and then it turns into, you know, you have rights, you know, you do have rights to have playtime. But then I thought, now then, for the 10 to 15 year olds, what will I do? And now this is where I have to say it's a gift. It's nothing to do with being clever. I went to bed, and it must have been very close to Christmas Eve, and in the middle of the night I thought of a rap song for them. We could get it was and it picked all the eyes out of what was important. So it said, if you're a kid in care, knowing your rights is fine. The Charter of Rights was written in 99. It was written so that kids could be cool and understand your rights are protected in Queensland. You have a right to be happy and to have a say on your daily needs when you cruise and to stay. And if you want to find out what's happening for you, you have a right to straight answers, not a no can do. You have a right to keep in touch with your family, friends from the past and your community. And when decisions are made, you have a right to have a say on your daily needs and where you live each day. And then it goes on about medical. You've got it, because often kids in care might be housed with someone who doesn't believe in medical intervention. Yeah. And so then you have a child who struggles with a sore throat, but they're not allowed to parent. And so kids need to know that they have a right. And if it's not being given to them, tell someone. So it goes on to talk about medical intervention. And it finishes with, you have a right to be, let me think how it finishes, but it finishes with basically saying, you know, you got rights, you got rights, you got rights for yourself, kids, you got rights, you got rights for yourself, kids, you got rights. Yes, taking care of yourself is a way to go. You've got a right to seek help from a medico. Taking care of yourself is a way to go. Mm. So when it came to presenting it, we thought it'd be really good if you could get some kids on board. Yep. So we had one linchpin kid who was actually known by somebody I worked with, but he knew a lot of kids who hung out in Queen Street Mall who were almost sort of, I'm not sure if they were quite homeless, but they were little vagabonds who were, but anyway, we raked them all into the department and we got them singing this song. And I was like the choir mistress. Then one kid who wasn't part of the rapping could do the beatbox with his cheeks, and so he with the microphone he'd be going and so it was really just a team of vagabonds, but we took them to Parliament House and they actually presented the Charter of Rights for Children in Care rap, and it got a standing ovation and they had to do it a second time, which was so good for them, as well as the morning tea that was provided, which was
a bit of free food always helps.
I promised them there'd be food and there was, and then that was put onto a tape so that foster parents could play it in the car because it was very catchy, and also the other little rhyming was on the other, flip side of the tape. And so that was Charter of Rights plus the younger one, but it was also made into a little Z card, which was the shape of a credit card, but it's concertinas open, so that the whole of those words is on that little card that they could keep in their jeans pocket or their shirt pocket to remind themselves of their rights.
I love that.
Because there were a lot of things that used to concern me in my work when I heard these stories, like not being able to see a medico, or even sometimes people carelessly talking about why the child's in care, which is really nobody else's business, but the child's and the professional. professional, you know, yeah. than the carer. So that alarmed me too. So in my little rap song, it also mentions that, you know, it's people don't need to know about that kind of stuff. Only people who care will be quiet enough. Yeah. You know, give children permission when someone says, you know, what happened to you? That's my business.
Yeah.
You know, Absolutely. That's private. We give them some words so that they have got an easy answer that doesn't make them feel they're being cheeky.
Yeah.
To protect themselves.
They're not going to get told off for saying the wrong thing or keeping secrets.
Yes, yes. And also for adults to know that. You've got no right to ask a child.
Mm. And it is so hard for children because they're so powerless in so many things. My children struggle with this. My 11-year-old last night said, children aren't equal, because we've been reading the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. quotes. I went to his museum last week in Memphis and I got this book of quotes. I thought, I'm going to read this with my son. And one of the first things was, you know, his fight was that all people would be equal. And I was explaining to him about the discrimination towards black people and how it has been and we still struggle. And he was like, but children aren't equal. And I was like, no, in human rights, on a certain level, children are equal, and we don't let you work and we don't let you drink alcohol and all these things because we know that it's not good for you. Mm. It's not because you don't have equal human rights. And he struggled with that because I think, you know, kids do feel really powerless and it's hard to know what is a rule that's there or a law that's there to protect them.
Mm.
Versus, you know, when we were talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, black people weren't allowed to eat in white people restaurants and things like that. And we said, well, that's not equal. Mm. That's not fair.
Mm.
And I think, you know, as a kid, that must be so hard to comprehend because they feel ostracized sometimes because of their age.
Yes, yes. But to my way of thinking, if a child said that to me, I would be saying that there's going to be a few years where there is an inequality because I have a responsibility of caring for you.
Mm.
And when you're little, you sometimes, for example, you might think, oh, let me drive the car down the driveway because I've seen dad do it, I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this child's 11 years old, you know, and he probably does know how to do it.
Yeah.
But you have a responsibility to that child. So there is an inequality where you have to be the super person over them that says, no, you can't do that, darling, because you might have an accident and you're too precious for that to happen to.
And it's protection and love.
Yes.
And I've tried to explain that too because my children are very good at getting my emotions up and I get angry, especially when they were toddlers. And I'd always tell them if I got angry, I'd always apologize if it was too inappropriate. But I'd always say that it's because I care and it's because I love you and I'm protecting you and I want to keep you safe because my children would run away. I'm that mum would lose my kids in the shopping centre all the time and I'd get so angry. And I'd say, I'm not angry at you. I'm upset because I love you and I want to keep you safe. And, and they don't know all the dangers that are out there. And as an adult, you become aware of.
That's right,
Not because of them but other people as well. And it's so hard.
And I know when I wrote the book last year, Jack Changes the Game, about online safety for young children, I really wanted to make the point that grown-ups get tricked too.
Yep.
So we need to protect our children from getting tricked and trapped on the internet, but also to at times admit that we've been scammed too and that we're not infallible.
No.
Because then it makes it easier for them to tell us when things go wrong for them.
Absolutely. Yes.
But going back to your child's comment, I was busy writing books about It's Okay to Say No when my children were growing up.
Whoa.
And so
they like that word, don't they?
They do like the word. So then it was my son's turn to wash the dishes and we've never had a dishwasher in our house. So so he stood me up. He said, I don't want to put my hands in the soapy water and my body belongs to me and I have the rights to say no. And he was probably 13.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, all right, you make a point. But I said, I don't think that you're an unfair person. And if I wash up tonight, then there's other jobs to be done. So would you like to do one of the other jobs if you don't want to put your hands in the soapy water? Because I can't believe you're going to be so unfair that you think every single job is mine.
Yeah.
And so I was about to do some ironing. You know, would you like to iron or would you like to just peg those clothes on the line while I wash up that are in the washing machine right now? That was a good answer because he decided he'd wash up.
Oh, good. And you're like, okay, so it is fair. And that is a challenging one.
Yes.
Because, you know, toddlers, you're doing everything for them. And at some point, you've got to start teaching them how to do the dishes. So
you're
not picking up after them and they're acting like spoiled brats all the time. And I'm definitely going through that experience at the moment. We could talk all day about that, though. So tell me some more about all these books that sounds like, you know, you've built a name for yourself as being a creative writer, specifically in children. That's how we met at the Queensland Police Children's Advocacy Group, because I met Kim Calloway through a friend, and I got to sing at their event that they had on International Women's Day. But we're both really passionate about children's protection and shit, so she invited me to the group where I met you. And now you have all of these books, and I mean, I want all of them for my children, just so you know. But there was one specific one that's done really well, and you have an interesting story about why you think it went so well. It's Everyone's Got a Bottom, which a lot of people probably have heard of in Australia. But tell us about how you got into that one and why it became so popular.
It probably was about the 10th book I was asked to write, because I just kept writing a book upon book upon book, for not only for the department, but occasionally they'd loan me out to another department to write a book. So Family Planning Queensland asked me to write a book, and I'd already written a couple of other books along the same lines. Touches and Feelings is sitting there. But they wanted me to write a book that spelt out the correct name for body parts so that children could be easily understood. Now, the background to children and the necessity for having the correct name for body parts is that if someone is touching them in an inappropriate way, you've got to give them the language so that they can tell someone and be understood. For example,
I didn't have the language when I was a kid.
One parent came in when I was in my work, QCPCA, and said that she'd already told her little girl that no one must touch her dinky. And so I just said, well, in England, a dinky is a three-wheeler little bike.
Yeah.
So if your daughter said, he's touching my dinky, then I would think she should be a good sharer because I'm busy. I've got all these other children to watch.
Yeah.
And so it's really important that you give the child the correct name as well as dinky so that if she's away from home, she'll be understood. And so I'm really, it's a big one because I've seen little children who say, he touched me on my, and then come up with a family name. And it cannot go to court because it can never be proved that the person, the perpetrator, actually did touch the child's vulva, vagina, anus. Unless a child has the language, it can't go to court, because it would then seem, if you tell the child the correct name for where he touched you, that you've groomed them, schooled them to be vindictive to this poor person, you know, who and so I've seen that happen quite a few times, where the child's not had the correct language and it has to be dismissed. It never gets to court, because
we are, though, like, as adults, there is this shame. Even, you know, we're a different generation, right? Like, you're probably
I'm
my
a grandma.
Mum's age. And I'm still a young mum, I think.
Yes, you are
but
a young mum.
Like, even me, when washing my children and teaching my boys to clean their penis, and my, you know, my daughter to clean her vagina, and like just and helping them, it is something that even I still go, oh, like, how do I get around this, because there's shame, and it's so tempting to call them different names and to call them something else, because but then it puts this shame over it, like there's shame in that area. And I'm you know my history, and I'm very much into child protection, and I agree, I don't want my daughter to feel shame on any part of her body, and I want her to know what good touch and love feels like. And you know, I'm conscious about that, even just drying her, because she's autistic, so I still have to help her a lot in the grooming and taking care of her body parts. But it's so hard because I still feel that, like, oh, you know, it's weird. How do we do that? I don't know. I don't know how we're changing it. But
it's a bit like everything. It's practice. And this is where Everyone's Got a Bottom, which was the resulting book, comes about, because it talks about vulvas and vaginas. And I'm amazed how many times vagina gets mentioned. Nobody ever mentions the vulva, which is the front part. So quite often I think vagina gets mistaken for the vulva. The bottom, your anus. And so this little book, it's a delightful book, and it's beautifully illustrated. And it's and on every page there's a little Soxie the cat. So you can read it to a young child who might not really understand the whole concept of the story, but get them looking out for Soxie on each page, and you'll engage with them because they'll keep watching out for where the cat is. And at the same time, they're learning in that sort of subliminal way the correct name. So we're talking about nipples and the little child who's telling the story in Everyone's Got a Bottom is pointing out these words. Yeah. And of course, the message is that no one is allowed to touch these private parts without good reason. And of course, that's just a gentle conversation to have with a child who's obviously slightly older than three. Yes. I mean, three, you'd get them looking at the pictures, but you're giving them the correct names. Yep. But as the child matures, that's when you can just expand a little bit on what does that mean? Because you might have to, for example, my son once injured himself on his little bike, and he was only a schoolboy, but he was very sore, and we needed to get, well, I certainly needed to have a look first of all, because he was bleeding, and I needed to see what damage he'd done to it. I wasn't sure where he'd hurt himself, whether it was testicles or penis. But then if I had, I didn't need to take him to the doctor, but if I had, then I would be able to say, this is one of the good reasons why we need to show Dr. So-and-so your penis and your testicles, because you've bumped yourself on your bike and we just need to make sure everything's okay.
Yep.
So, you know, you can expand the conversation as the child understands. But I don't think we should ever give a child age inappropriate information. And so one of the things I was asked was to mention the mouth in Everyone's Got a Bottom, because the mouth is one of the most common places where a very, very young child is sexually abused. And so I came home having been given this brief of needing to mention the mouth because of oral sex. Now, I don't think little children need to know anything at all about oral sex. All they need to know is that their mouth is just another thing that when you're learning how to brush your teeth, and this is how the storyline goes, you might need help when you're little. But when you're older, you brush your teeth yourself. And then we've got the older boy who's telling the story saying, I don't like kissing people. And that is so common. So once again, it's a really good example of giving a child the power of saying no. You don't have to kiss everybody. It might be good to say why, if they pick out one person they don't want to kiss, because in one of my client cases, apparently granddad was poking his tongue down her throat when he was giving a kiss. And she told mum that she didn't want to kiss granddad anymore, and she got a good hiding. And so... it's important that children are given that permission. And you could say why. And it might just be that he smokes and his breath smells, or it might be that he's got a moustache that tickles. That's fine. But you don't have to kiss him if it tickles. What would you like to do? Give him a nice hug? Give him a nice hug and tell him.
Or a high five or a fist pump or whatever.
A high five, that's right. And be just not dictatorial about it. In fact, congratulate the child for being able to tell you that they don't like kissing everybody. They don't
have to kiss
everybody.
And trusting their intuition. Because I definitely have memories of speaking up and saying, I don't like this person. I don't want to spend time with them. And I was told off. It was unkind to not like someone for no reason. And I didn't have the vocabulary to say why I didn't like them.
What the reason was, so this little book, it just starts those gentle conversations with your children in a fun way, because I've had a lot of fun writing it, and I have got a sense of humour. So we've got the cat that dances right through the book, but the very last page is when, and I'm sure if anyone's had a cat, they'll picture this, because you've got everybody sitting there and the cat marches in, plonks itself in the middle of the room and starts licking its bottom. And so that's the very best back page. The cat's got his hand leg over its ear. and so the very last word is, oh, no more bottoms. And the cat's there. And Daddy says, yes, everyone's got a bottom. And then there's a repetitive phrase that goes right through it that says, from my head to my toes, I can say what goes.
I love that.
And it's just a completely... repeats itself through and through, so that children have even got a little saying, which I did get some nice feedback from a relative who was making a dinosaur suit for her little grandchild, and she was doing that measuring bit when it's an all-in-one jumpsuit, you know, between the belly button and then through your legs and up to the back and the middle of your back, so the tape measure comes right through all those private parts. And this little girl said to grandma, hey, Grandma, from my head to my toes, I can say what goes. She didn't particularly like this tape measure between her legs.
Yeah, fair enough.
And it made everybody laugh, but there's a girl who's remembered the phrase. And isn't it good she was able to speak out? She felt a bit uncomfortable with this tape measure being held in all these...
And I think kids do really connect to rhyming, especially like that young age group. They remember it flows off the tongue. for some reason it sticks better in their brain, which is why nursery rhymes do so well. Yes. And I love that. And you said, you told me before this that someone from the ABC, they banned the book.
Yes, when Everyone's Got a Bottom came out, and I must admit, I had a bit of a tussle with the organisation that asked me to write it because they didn't like the title. Some of the people on the committee thought that it might be offensive, Everyone's Got a Bottom, apart from the fact that the grammar isn't really correct. Mm-hmm. But so I have a lot of school teachers who still order, Everyone Has a Bottom.
Has a bottom.
And it always makes me smile because I think that's the
it's
teacher
in
you.
Australian though, isn't it? Everyone's Got a Bottom.
Everyone's Got a Bottom.
Yeah.
And so the book was launched and Eddie Groves from ABC Learning Centres banned it, and he said that it's gone too far. The author has gone too far, and it made it into the Sunday Mail newspaper.
Mm.
And as a result, there was a lot of hoo-ha then on talkback radio and people writing to the paper about, you know, isn't it disgusting that we're teaching children all this stuff that they don't really need to know when they're very little?
Mm-hmm.
And then we would also have an enormous amount of people saying, don't be silly, you know, what year are we in now? Surely we can talk about vulvas and vaginas and penises. And so the biggest thing that banning the book did was that within the week, the book had completely sold out and everywhere in Australia wanted to talk to the organisation that asked me to write it.
There you go.
And so it's been a bestseller ever since. It has sold over 50,000 copies.
Yep.
And I've now got the rights to sell it myself because the organisation have given me back my intellectual property. It's the first book I've actually sold myself. And the artist who illustrated it now lives in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So she's just about to start trying to float it onto the American audience because it really is an important book. It's probably amongst my books I've written the most important because it does give children that education and it gives the power to parents who are feeling nervous. How do you broach this subject? To just a gentle little bedtime read. And in fact, most parents have told me that the kid wants it night after night after night. I think it's because there's a bare bottom in it.
Yeah, and it's cheeky.
It makes you giggle. And yes, and it is cheeky and it's lovely because that's the innocence of childhood.
Yeah.
And we don't, look, being a mum, I'm now a grandma. We don't want to take the innocence away from children.
No.
We just want to give that innocence a little bit of information that's age appropriate so that they can look after themselves when you're not around and be understood and heard.
It's such an amazing thing what you've done and you've done it. I can see you've got my dad's in prison and I'm scared when mum and dad fight and hands of holding. I mean, and you've done so much for children and I can see that it comes from such a beautiful place. So I'm going to put links and you know, put all of the titles so that people can see all your work on the blog, on the podcast.
Oh, that's lovely.
As well.
Thank you.
You can go and find it.
I mean, what I really appreciate what you're doing today is giving these organisations some marketing because nobody has a marketing budget. And so, and yet I've chosen to write for organisations because A, they get the product they want. And at the same time, if they sell the book, and I always say try and keep it affordable so people can afford it. The profit goes either into the service they deliver, which for some of my books is helping women escape domestic violence, or to print the book again so that they don't run out of print.
And it's such a massive thing. When I was working and I went to the event where I performed for the Queensland Police on International Women's Day, I was ashamed to admit that I was so unaware of still how much of a massive problem domestic violence is in Australia and how many women die on a regular basis from domestic violence, and that I think they said something like 40% of calls to 000 are domestic arguments and they're you know, danger in the home.
Yes.
It's not, we don't need to be as afraid of, you know, people down the street and things like that. It's the people that we love. It's our emotions that are, you know, we're emotionally unintelligent on a lot of areas and there's so many attachment issues which comes from being when we're kids and not having proper education and all of this stuff is going to impact generations after.
In fact, one book which I've got here, My Friend Gordon, came about when there was the most, anyone who lived in Brisbane would remember it, the Camp Hill woman who was set on fire with the children, and the children and the mother died. Yep. And that horrified everybody. And I realised that if only we could teach small children that part of being a good friend is letting go, we might be able to influence this generation growing up now to consider that part of any relationship is the ability to let go when that person wants to move on.
Yeah.
And we might be able to reduce that knee-jerk reaction that happens when a woman wants to separate and the man's out for revenge. And so I started mulling over the idea of writing a children's book, and it was like the stars lined up, because then I got a call from the Centre for Women, which is situated in Logan, and they asked me if I was still writing books and would I write one for them. And so it was sort of that hallelujah moment. Yeah. And I said, look, I've got this idea and it's about letting go. It's teaching children to let go. And they immediately snapped it up and said, write it, we want it. And so My Friend Gordon is a story teaching children, and I did actually ring up childcare centres and said, am I on the right page, do you know, what do you think? And they said, look, in preschool, because it's preschool, primary school, this book targeting, we have best friends one day, next day a child wants to play with someone else, World War III is about to erupt.
And, I've experienced that.
Yes, I think everybody has. And so at the launch, I've got a repetitive phrase in this, because Gordon, by the way, is a rescue dog. And so the little boy learns how to be kind to the rescue dog when it comes to his house, because, of course, he first of all thinks it's going to be just a wonderful playmate, and he wants to play with the dog who's still settling in and very nervous. So there's some lovely, the illustrations are beautiful.
So pretty.
And so we've got the dog hiding under the coffee table, and we've got the little boy saying, come out, I want to play. And of course the mum says, you've got to talk in a soft voice if you want to be friends, you know. So he's learning how to be a friend by talking in a soft voice. And then they take the dog to a dog park, and the dog wants to play with other dogs.
Yep.
And so once again, he's annoyed, you know, because he wants the dog to play with him in the dog park and throw a ball, but the dog's not interested. And daddy says, hey, remember, you know, you've got to be a good friend, you've got to let go. So he's in all these little gentle ways, we're teaching a child about letting go. And so at different stages of the child's life, a situation arises where he needs to use that skill he's learned. And so there's the catchphrase, then I remembered Gordon.
Yeah.
And it just keeps popping up all over the place when a friend doesn't want to play with him, or when a new person starts to school, then the new person feels just like Gordon did. He curls up small and everybody's wanting to pick at him. And so then he remembered Gordon and to speak in a soft voice and get help, because there were some bullies teasing. And so... It's a really, I love this book and I love the illustrations.
It's so beautiful.
And so on the way home from the dog park, the dog's matching along and he licks Dad's hand, and Dad says, I think he's saying thank you, Dad said. Thank you for letting me play with some new friends. And so the dog is the guiding light for the story. And then at the very end, the skills that he's learned is when I want a friend to play with, I have lots of friends to choose from. So if you do let go, a friend wants to play with somebody else, that's a part of resilience building. What do you do? So you might find a new friend, or you might find a new thing to do while your friend's playing with the other friends. But then on Saturdays and Sundays when I'm not at school, then I remember Gordon, because then, you know, he plays in the yard with the dog and throws the ball. So lovely little message. And at the launch, when I read the book out in full, I said that what I'd really like to think is it becomes a family saying, so that when you've got your teenage daughter and her boyfriend's gone off with her bestie and she's ready to kill them both, then, you know, I want mum or dad to say, hey, remember Gordon?
Yes.
Remember Gordon. Let go. You know, wish them well. And who knows, you know, he might even come back to you, or you'll find somebody that you like even better.
Yeah.
And so I think if we can encourage children to build those skills of letting go, we might just help the next generation of males.
Absolutely.
Because it seems to be more of a male thing.
Well, it's a part of learning secure attachment styles, which...
Yeah.
You know, I had to learn attachment styles as an adult it was definitely not something that was taught as a child or even a teenager. And yet it's so important, isn't it?
Yes.
How we attach to ourselves but also other people and yeah, being able to let go and move on and being okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very hard. So we've talked a lot about your kids' books.
Yes.
And I'm gonna put them in there. And then there's this one other one which we'll touch on quickly. Tell me about the one that I'm holding.
Now, Remembering Nazareth House came about because while I was working in the centre, QCPCA, we were asking for volunteers to come and help us when we had stands with our literature and information. And one lady came and I was the recruiting officer. And mm-hmm. so I interviewed her, and part of my spiel was some of the training is just understanding child abuse, because we've taken a step forward from thinking child abusers are baddies in one corner and where the good is in the other corner. Mm. Because the reality is we're all capable of harming children when we're frustrated or worried. Or and so we're wanting to normalise that children who harm children. However, I didn't even get any further because she jumped in on me and said, I know all about child abuse. You don't need to tell me anything. I grew up in an orphanage in Brisbane. And she told me her story. And as I was showing her out at the end of that interview, which was really her telling me her life story, she turned around and said, so did you believe all that stuff I just told you? And I was quite shocked because, of course, I believed her.
Yeah.
And she was equally shocked that she'd told me a story that she had never told anybody ever before. And I'd listened to her and I'd believed her.
Mm.
And so, I reassured her, and she was, I could see I'd moved her enormously, because she said, I've never, ever told anybody. I thought, and it was nuns and priests in a Catholic orphanage. And a few days later, she rang and said, I've been getting in touch with the women who I'm still in touch with from the orphanage, and they want to tell you their story. They've never told anybody either. Well, and I wasn't allowed to do it from work. So I said, look, if you can set up somewhere one weekend, I'll make myself available and let's meet, you know.
Yep.
So she opened her house up. 15 women turned up this particular day. Oh. And I walked into the house of 15 women. It was so much jollity, and because it was the first time they'd ever all been together, which was amazing in itself. Oh. And one lady had even come from Sydney. Oh. And they were all having fun together. And then we sat down, and it was just like the temperature went down to zero, because they started talking about their childhood, and there were tears and there were hugs and emotion. It was just the most amazing afternoon of hearing their stories. And when it came time for me to go, of course I was madly taping and scribbling all at the same time, everything they said, one of the ladies said, will you write a book about us? They knew I already wrote children's books. Will you write a book about us? And I said, I think I must have had, we certainly hadn't been drinking anyway, only cups of tea.
Yeah.
But I was on a high, obviously, because I said yes, never having any idea what I was, never having written an adult book in my life before.
Yeah.
Anyway, I started writing their story, and then I sent the first draft out. It probably took me 6 months to write the first draft, because I was working full time and I still had children at home. So, and everything else that happens around that. So sent the first draft and one to Sydney. And it was always such a slow process. It actually took me over 20 years to write the book, because the slow process of then getting back the feedback and them saying, oh, that's not quite true, that wasn't quite how it was, and we weren't allowed to talk to each other, so you can't have us talking to each other because we'd have gotten into trouble if...
Yeah.
And on it went. And at one stage, they weren't allowed to put their hands under the covers in bed. They had to sleep with their arms across their chests with a hand on each shoulder. So if you can imagine crossed arms, hands, and yet that's how you had to sleep. And that was to stop you touching yourself.
Oh my
goodness. And the nun would march up and down, and your hands were not allowed to be under the covers. So while I'm writing the story, I'm trying to bring these children to life. And the main character, who's quite a feisty little woman, she's the one that lived closest to me, so she was the easiest one to relate with. I've just got her sneaking her hands under on a very cold night, and bearing in mind that the dormitory she was in at the time had an open veranda on a hill in Wynnum, Brisbane, in the winter. Mm. So I've just got her sneaking her hands under the covers because she's so cold and her nose is running, and putting her hands between her knees. Well,
to warm up,
she got the draft. When she finally rang me, I thought she was going to jump down the line and strangle me. You cannot write that about me. I never, ever put my hands in between my legs. I didn't do it then and I wouldn't do it now. And oh, so it's funny with hindsight, but she was so incensed. And the sad thing about these women is they still carried all the torture of thinking that if they were to be found out for having put their hands between their knees, retribution might still come from heaven, you know. So so that's why it was such a long write. And then probably 10 or 12 years into writing this book, I realised, don't ask me why it didn't cross my mind, that the majority of these women couldn't read or write. They had never been taught to read or write. They didn't go to a proper school at the orphanage. This is set in the 1940s, 1950s, and the school teachers were nuns from Ireland who were barely literate themselves, most of them.
Yeah.
And so I hadn't realised that why it was taking so long to get the feedback was they had to wait for someone to come to their house who they could trust to tell them that they couldn't read and write, and then for that person to write the reply to me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it is an oh, my goodness, isn't it?
It's an embarrassing thing for a lot of people.
Absolutely, yes.
To not be able to do that.
And so the book finally got finished because Queensland Writers' Centre gave me a scholarship to, it was a residency. Mm-hmm. No money was involved, but I got the residency to be the Queensland Writers in Resident, which allowed me to then have access to someone who could mentor me a bit. So I took this manuscript and said, look, I've been writing it for 20 odd years. Please, can we just finish it? And I told her the story and she said, look, it's called speculative memoir. You have to speculate. You didn't walk in their shoes.
Yeah.
So you have to speculate. And she said, you have to tell them that they have to let go of you and let you write this book. And, you know, it was just like the bird was set free. I let them know. I think they were all sick of me anyway.
Yeah.
And some of them had passed away, sadly, because they were all not strong and healthy women, having had the childhood they'd had.
Yeah.
And they gave me the freedom. And I just went like the wind. It was a bird being released into the air. And I finished the book and then couldn't get a publisher. But then I got a grant from the National Redress Scheme for children who'd been abused in institutions. And so we were managed to do a small print run of 250 copies, and Queensland Writers' Centre did the editing, so they were amazing. And we had the launch. We gave away, anybody who's been in an orphanage gets a free copy. So I had a couple of hundred books left from the 250 after the launch. No bookshop would take them. It was September and all bookshops were full up for Christmas stock. And so I got one secondhand bookshop, Giggle Fit Grammar in Wynnum. I promised him I'd always give him a plug. Took five. And one lady read it and within days had on Facebook, Wynnum What Facebook. It's an amazing book, well written. It was a page turner, couldn't put it down. And as a result, it was Wynnum What Facebook was just deluged. Now, I don't do Facebook, but a friend saw it. Let everybody know, was begging, where do you buy it from, that she knew me and she'd get some copies and come to her house. And within 24 hours, she'd sold 20 copies, far more than my five. And by the end of the week, we'd sold out completely. And we had a 500 print run, which we sold out in the next couple of weeks. And then in 12 weeks, we sold 1,200 copies.
It's absolutely
It was
incredible.
Amazing. And then that Christmas, it got the David Malouf Jono Award through Queensland Writers' Centre. And so I couldn't wait to do another print run and put on the back the recipient, the Jono Award recipient, because I was so proud about that. And as a result, I've printed more, but we really need to push it beyond Queensland now because the sales have, and I don't have a marketing budget
and
at all.
It's still on topic. I mean, I've got a friend who is of my parents who is still going through one of the court cases. That's still, I mean, it's, I think it's been 12 years because he was an orphanage boy in Queensland and a Catholic priest abused him and a lot of other men. And, you know, it's still going. And it's horrific. But it's something that has to be done and it does take time, unfortunately. But it has, it's played a massive role in my life because when it first started going, it was in the news a lot. And that was hearing that people were actually listening and taking it seriously gave me a little bit of hope that if I spoke up someone might actually believe me.
Yes.
And that something might happen. And I wasn't going to be ostracized and put down for even saying something.
Yes.
Which I know my aunties and my mum were impacted by the same person who impacted me, and it all got shoved under the carpet because if something happened in that generation, it was the woman's fault.
That's right.
You were alone in a room with a man and you got abused. That's your fault for being alone in the room with a man.
Yes.
And there was no responsibility put on the man. And so, you know, I think it's been a really big changer, and the fact that you've been able to document some people's stories is going to help so many people. So hopefully if anyone's listening to this, they're going to grab a copy, and I'm going to put into the podcast blog. I'll put all the links and all the ways that they can get in contact with you, and they can find these different books that you've been able to be a part of.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for the life's work that you have put into this. I'm sure you're going to keep doing it.
Oh,
are you working on anything at the moment?
Yes. I'm writing a book for Mater Children's Hospital, and then I'm also writing a book for a New South Wales city council, on gender equity for little children.
Amazing.
And so that book will come out May next year. And for Domestic Violence Week, and I'm not sure about the Mater Children's Hospital one, what their time frame is.
Yeah.
I've written it, being illustrated, and so, but that's targeting children who, it's really, from all my books about it's okay to say no and speak out, this is what happens next when you do speak out. So the Children's Hospital book is all about what happens next, so that children can be reassured that they will be respected and believed. And it's better to tell than to keep it within yourself until you're an adult. That's really torturous, and
it is,
and so unfair. Probably the last word I'll say is that feedback from Nazareth House, one came from someone from Rockhampton who hadn't been in Nazareth House Orphanage, a different orphanage, but she thanked me for writing her story, because everybody who reads this book will realise it's a story that's gone right around Australia, not just Catholic, Salvation Army institutions, Anglican.
It's, Pentecostal.
Yes, and she said that you've listened to them and believed them and given them a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And she assured me that when children are listened to and believed and given a voice, the healing starts.
And I think that's what we do as creative writers, and as a songwriter or a writer in general, we're taking what's out there, and we're trying to put it into a creative aspect that's palatable and a way that we can share stories. And it is a gift that you've been given. And I feel like when you get to those pearly gates, you can say for sure that you've used your gift to an absolute capacity and had your own family and grandchildren. I think you've been blessed a million times over. And I'm so grateful that you've come in and shared a part of your story with me. Is there anything else you would like to share before we finish up with the people who are listening?
Probably for anyone listening who's aspiring to be a writer or whatever you're aspiring to be, you know, believe in yourself, because it's so easy to dismiss yourself and think, oh, I'm so busy, I've got children. But, you know, make some time for yourself so that you can blossom and grow too, because it's such a good example you're setting your children.
Amen. Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much, Tess. This is so exciting, and it is an unusual podcast to what we've usually done.
Yeah.
I haven't had many authors on, but there's so much overlap, and like you said, it's just so important. And to believe in yourself is something that is hard to do without other people encouraging you and inspiring us to keep going. And I find you so incredibly inspiring. And if I can do half of what you've done in your lifetime, by the time I'm your age, I will be very proud. So thank you so much for what you're doing and continuing to do. I think it's amazing.
I've got no doubt that you will have absolutely gone past the goalpost.
Well, I'm just going to keep doing it just like you said. Plus. Keep going. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining our songwriter Trist today. To join the family and keep up to date with future podcasts, you can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Please leave a review and subscribe. To support the podcast or contact me or our guest, please go to the website songwritertrists.com.